Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore.
Ding-a-ling. Here we are with the Media Project. Wonderful opportunity for you to get a half hour of commentary, analysis, and if you're lucky, a little bit of insight into the news media issues of the week. Hello, folks. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union in Albany, here with Rosemary Armeo, investigative journalist and University of Albany professor.
Good Rosemary. Morning.
How do? Good day, mm-hmm. good evening, whatever. Whatever time of day we might be. And Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. Do you feel different, Alan, in the years since your title became CEO as opposed to executive director? Is this an inflation? This is word title inflation, don't you think? Not to lead the witness or anything, but what do you think about a media organization that has a CEO?
I didn't even know it happened. I didn't even know it happened. Frankly, what happened was that I was both the chair of the board and the executive director.
That's kind of like being your own grandpa, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we decided that wasn't such a good idea, and we decided I would just become the president of the company and the CEO. I don't know who did that, and frankly, I don't care because I don't think titles mean that much.
But I remember when my publisher, when I was a reporter at Newsday, my publisher, a new publisher came in and put the name CEO on the masthead. It was the first time I'd seen it in a newspaper, and now it's... Every organization has a CEO. You see these startups who are basically three-person organizations and somebody's a CEO.
I think it means you're the boss.
Oh, okay. All right, well, the boss is here. The boss is in the room, and we are going to go forward with media issues. There's a wonderful thing that people talk about all the time, and that is that I know what I know because of Jon Stewart or because of Stephen Colbert, and now there is actually a study. And since you... two are both connected to academia, you appreciate academic studies.
Studies
are important. Mm-hmm. There is actually the first study showing that Colbert is doing a better job than the other news sources at teaching people about an issue, that being campaign financing. Mm-hmm. How about that? This comes from the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania, and they have found that Colbert did better than every other news source in their model.
Well, I absolutely agree with it. There was a study years ago that showed that many people got their news from this very source, many young people, and that was their only source of this information. So I'm thinking this isn't too surprising, but I'm glad that somebody did the academic study that proves it.
There's a reason that so many young people get their news from Colbert and from Jon Stewart. It's because their format allows for things that we have just culled out of traditional reporting. They make fun. They use jokes. They use satire. We don't do that. And in this case, with campaign financing, you'll recall Stephen Colbert actually ran for office. He used a gimmick. He set up a PAC. He took financing from a secret organization. He also set up. And all of this he described to his viewers. He brought them along on the ride. He engaged them. We do not do that enough with our readers. I remember a few years ago, Washington Post reporter Gene Weingarten from Albany originally took Joshua Bell, the world-class violinist.
One of the best things that ever happened.
It was a great story. And he put him in the metro system in Washington, had him play the violin, and recorded people as they walked by every day, some few pennies in. Very few stopped and listened. This is a man for whom you would pay about $100 for a ticket
at least.
To go here. And this became the basis for a story about the nature of beauty, the commercialization of art, all these big issues. It was just wonderful reporting. Won a Pulitzer Prize for it. And he was much criticized because of the deceit involved in putting, for doing an experiment, basically.
It's unbelievable. You know, I've interviewed him a number of times, Bell, and I've asked him about it. because people always know the story, and he never wants to talk about it anymore. He said, it's enough already.
Listen to my music. You know, it is almost like Colbert is part of a tradition that in a way began with what was called the New Journalism in the 1970s, practiced by Tom Wolfe and Gay Talese and others, and that is what one of my mentors used to call participant observation journalism.
Right. We have that in Academy, too.
Involvement at,
We have this in the Academy. One of the major ways in which one does research is what Margaret Mead would have called participant observation. You live among the Samoans or the Dobu.
I did this when I was living in New York City. I wanted to report about a young woman whom I had known earlier, who had become a poet and a publisher of a pornographic magazine on the Lower East Side. And basically, she supported herself by selling speed.
Sounds like a good story.
It was really interesting. I mean, it was a window into an area of culture that I certainly didn't know anything about. I mean, I'm from South Dakota. What is this? But it was. So I spent lots and lots of time with this woman. But you really need to immerse yourself in it. And of course, the hazard of that is that, as you said, Alan, you go native, you'd lose your ability to write thoughtfully about it because you become an advocate. Or is that?
Back to what you just said about the early journalists who did this kind of thing, and Rosemary said, but you know, Will Rogers did it.
Yeah,
Will Rogers did it. He made fun of them, and by making fun of them, he taught people.
He was another person who had wide influence because people would tune into him. You know,
that's
something about journalism. You don't have any influence.
And Mark Twain
did the same, right?
We became enamored of the idea, and I think that I probably more than you guys still remain this way. I'm a great believer in independent journalism and saying, you know, we're going to give you as straight a view of things as we can give. The difficulty with that is that the term that has been applied to it and we've used here in this program before is you become the voice from nowhere. You become a point of view that is so removed from reality that you're not giving people a real picture.
Dispassionate and even boring. There's another study from Poynter that took a look at the 1960 very famous documentary by Edward R. Murrow, Harvest of Shame. Mm. And you'll recall that was a look at migrant workers, one of the first at the time in the horrible conditions they were living in. It resulted in a great uproar and a lot of attention to the problem that had not happened before. It now is regarded as not even journalism, it's advocacy, because he was promoting the idea that we ought to do more for these workers, which we would not do now because of Rex's thing. You know, we have to be objective now. We can't take one side over the other.
And one of the reasons, Rosemary, you're absolutely right, and one of the reasons that we have seen people so angry about this is because they lose something. The moment you abandon advocacy in favor of truth, I would tell you, truth, there is somebody whose ox is going to get gored. Now, I happen to believe, if politics is the authoritative allocation of scarce resources, then I happen to believe that it is a scarce resource, journalists have power, and that the moment you tell those journalists, you have to shut up and only be, quote, down the middle, that you have lost the capacity to tell the truth. And that is awful. And so there's a lobbying effort that's going on here, isn't there? There's a lobbying effort on the part of those who have the most to lose to make sure that newspapers and radio stations and others don't do that kind of thing.
Isn't there a place, though, I hope there is, between down the middle, as you say, and truth, where a journalist can point to the truth without abandoning fairness, where you don't become an advocate, but you become a truth teller.
But the moment you do that, Rex, the moment you do that, somebody's going to yell at you.
Well, yes, but I think that you're taking an extreme position of saying you should be an advocate at all times as a journalist.
No.
And I don't think that's right.
No, I don't think that's what I'm saying. No, but I
think investigative reporting has always been, and that's what Harvest of Shame was, but investigative reporting has always been crusading. It's idealistic. You know, migrant workers should be treated well. That's a position. That's
or
a bias.
Or Joe McCarthy, the same man,
Edward
R. Murrow. And we honor Edward R. Murrow with all kinds of prizes, all kinds of awards. We've set up things in his name, the Murrow Awards, or this or that. Why? Well, let me tell you that my mother got a telephone call the night that Edward R. Murrow went on his with See It Now and the exposing of Joe McCarthy as a, well, are we allowed to use the B word? Probably not here.
And, bad man.
Yeah, bad man. And my mother got a call saying, they're going to come after Murrow with everything that they have. Could you make a telephone call to the television station
And so support him?
Then support him.
Support him.
Uh-huh.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, and they did. Exactly that. There was a whole outpouring, and he really broke the line. He did. But believe me, you want to talk about advocacy, he came right after McCarthy with everything he had.
I do want to just add, by the way, and out of loyalty, I was a student of a man named John Schultz, who was the editor of Harvest of Shame, and of Edward R. Murrow's executive producer, Fred Friendly, who became the president of CBS News. And those guys had a lot to do with this. It was really very much a team. We all salute Murrow because he was the face of this. He was much more than fronting the story, which is the term that's now used in broadcast news when somebody just sits there in front of the CBS 60 Minutes placard and reads the script. Murrow was deeply involved in it, but these guys were very much his partners and believed very deeply in what you're saying, which is that deep reporting can lead to a point of view.
One other thing I would say is that too often we in the traditional media try to keep it straight, as you say, and the result is we just turn off readers. I am interested in foreign news, and we could not get people interested in wars and famines, in 100 girls being stolen out of their school in Nigeria. How do you turn on people to a story like this if you're reporting it objectively and cold, if you give equal weight to the government saying, oh, it's no real problem? We don't. We don't see reaction. We see reaction when we engage people. And Colbert and his team, I think you're, again, right, he doesn't do that alone, put together a really amazing, we can call them gimmicks, but they're ways to engage people in the news or they're writing about.
One of the elements of this is we, in terms of engagement, which is really the key to this, one of the things that we don't do in America as much in engagement is give people the, almost literally, the guts of the story. We've talked here in this program before about the fact that Americans are really reluctant to see harsh photography. We don't like to see reality. The New Republic, an American magazine with limited readership, but an influential readership, published photos of a body after an execution, a botched execution that were taken by a medical examiner during the autopsy. It's a bit difficult to look at. I went online and looked at these photographs, and they're really quite remarkable. And we don't do that in my medium, in newspapering. We don't do very much photography at that because Americans don't like it.
Yeah, but when you think of the great photographs of our time, the one that always springs to everybody's mind is the Vietnamese guy with a gun to the to the suspect's head. Clearly, that guy was going to get killed.
And the girl running, burning with from napalm.
And then the burn, and also the girl burning with napalm.
Just to add one note here, those were played down in the American press. They ran in black and white. They would never have run in the American press in color, where you would have seen the skin burning off the
girl's
body.
Well, we didn't have the capacity to run color in newspapers
But that was
60s.
A decision, though, Rex. That
there was no capacity to do that.
Actually, there's video done by a British photographer, and that was in color.
American newspapers, you know, you can't apply today's standards to 1960s. There was no capacity to run color on the front page of American newspapers, just to be accurate.
But that was not the reason. I think if there had been capacity, they would not have run in color, and you do not see pictures out of Syria, which are equally searing. You do not see them in
our press. On the front page of the Times Union the picture from Fallujah that showed American bodies hanging from a bridge after being dragged in the streets. People were reluctant to use that, but it seemed, even at that moment, it seemed like a turning point in the war when people suddenly realized that this Iraq war is not what George W. Bush said it was going to be.
And that picture, they're kind of like very blackened figures. Yeah. They're hard to distinguish them even as bodies until you read the caption. You contrast that to places like Algeria where there's lots of terrorism and they run pictures of basically shredded babies on their front page because their view is this is what's happening in our lives. We need to see it.
It's truth. It's truth telling. But the fact is, if you do that in American media, you will lose your audience. People will rise up against you and throw things at you. And so you do have to make a decision if you're going to run a news organization. What price is truth telling?
How do we know that?
Well,
in other words, because you get telephone calls. On the other hand, you put a really sensitive picture on the front page of the paper. They may be talking about it at the West Stockbridge store. But the fact of the matter is they're talking about it.
Yeah, and now we have hits so we can measure it. When they put a beheading on, and again, on Algerian television, it just shut down the server. So many people went on. So there is an audience for it. But that's not the real point. I applaud the New Republic for doing this in the face of what is certain criticism, because there's an important debate going on in our country about executions and whether they are cruel and inhuman. Pictures from 2006 show some pretty extreme and inhuman kind of conditions.
Well,
Yeah, but why are they doing it? I mean, I have to think.
Because we have to, here's the answer. It's advocacy journalism. It actually goes back to what we were starting at the beginning. They feel comfortable saying, we're going to take a position. We can do this, right?
But are they taking the position? I mean, it's complicated, of course. Are they taking the position that they're doing it because it's good? Are they taking the position they're doing it because it's going to sell magazines and take them out of a also-ran magazine status and saying, boy, golly gee whiz, Martha, as you always say, Rex, you know, look at what they're doing and bringing them up a little bit. You know, the New Republic itself has had a checkered past. It's interesting. It started out as the great liberal magazine, and it had a period which it wasn't so liberal, and now I think they're back to being liberal again. But
there's nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong with an editor making a decision saying this is the right thing to do, and, oh, incidentally, people are going to be talking about the New Republic, and I'm going to sell more magazines.
No, that's right. Yeah. They're not mutually exclusive. On the other hand, almost everybody would always take the high road in terms of the argument about why you did it. We did it because we think it's our responsibility to bring the people the news. But there are many people who avoid certain subjects because they don't want to sell newspapers, because they're afraid of it hurting the bottom line.
Well, yes.
Or helping the bottom line.
And this is a case where they might have heard as much as helped. There's nothing. This is not like putting a sexy woman on your cover to get Kim Kardashian on your cover. This could have turned off as many people as would have attracted to them. So I really do think it was a principled stand that they're going to come out against executions,
you know,
or at least by this method.
Gun control is another such issue. We have a story about an NPR correspondent, David Shaper, who was reporting a story on the effort by Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago, to require video recordings of every gun purchase and limit one gun per customer per month. So this is a proposal that Rahm Emanuel has going in Chicago. And he witnessed a shooting while reporting on guns. And in this country, the reporting about guns is awkward, let's say, because of the power of the gun lobby. It makes it very difficult.
To put it at its very minimal, the power is amazing. So if a group is powerful, do we not do what we should? Guns are killing more people than anything else in this country. I mean, auto accidents, maybe more. But guns are responsible for a lot of deaths in this country. And if somebody's going to take a principled stand, even if there are many people, Americans, who are convinced to their very bottom of their souls, I got to carry a gun because somebody's going to do something to me and my family, and I got to shoot them if that happens, which rarely happens. But it's part of the American psyche, that gun and the car. And, you know, you don't mess with them.
But here's the hazard that we confront. And by the way, if you want to join the conversation, email us media@wamc.org. media@wamc.org. This is the Media Project. Alan Shartok, Rosemary Romeo, and Rex Smith here from Albany, New York, the studios of WAMC. Here's the hazard of this. If we get into a position where we are all practicing advocacy journalism, we're not going to have, aren't we going to then each go to our corners, go to our own respective media? We're not going to have any of that shared awareness of the news, no sensibility of what is truthful news telling and what is intentional distortion on behalf of advocacy.
So just ask CNN about that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Ha, ha, ha. Like, yeah, being straight and narrow, fair and balanced has brought us to a better position.
Yeah, so you mean Fox.
Yeah.
You know, Fox is number one. CNN is number three.
Yeah.
So how do you do that?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's better to explain your bias and write your stories with passion and feeling. The NPR story, I was most affected by the idea that he's writing on a story and into his viewfinder walks an example of the very thing he's talking about. That's the sort of thing that makes people hate us, because I'm sure he was thanking the journalism gods for that.
Yes.
It was a horrible thing that happened, and yet it was fantastic.
Well, explain
for him.
It a little bit more. It's just so...
Well, because he watched the shooting, and that's what he was reporting on, the danger of guns. So into his viewfinder comes, you know, an example of the very horrible thing he's talking about.
But it's difficult. You know, I think effective advocacy journalism is much more difficult to do right than not. That is, if you're teaching young journalists, you'd better teach them how to do stuff straight and factual before you just turn them loose on writing opinions.
I agree with that. Just like playing
the piano.
Yeah.
You know, first you have to learn your
or painting.
Scales.
You have to learn the masters before. Yeah, and we do it, we'll go overseas where there's a tradition of completely opinionated as opposed to informed opinion, which
to
is what they should be writing. And how do you teach that? Don't do any of it, just go completely flat? Or do you teach them, no, back up everything you're saying?
I think we should remember, and Rosemary, you're the historian amongst us, journalist journalistic historian, we should remember that's how American journalism started.
Absolutely.
We take a look at some of the things that were written about Thomas Jefferson, George Washington even. It was terrible, terrible stuff.
And people became publishers with the intent of supporting a political cause. Yeah. That was why they existed. The Times Union was founded in 1856 as the Albany Morning Times. And what set it apart initially in those early days was it said, we're going to be an independent newspaper. We're not going to be like these other papers that have their political biases.
But of course, it was a Hearst newspaper.
And no, it
Hearst
wasn't. Had, no, not until.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
No, it wasn't Hearst until 1952.
And then did they lose their way then, or what? I remember that old man Hearst's column appeared above the masthead every Sunday.
Well, that was actually the second generation Hearst used to appear.
But he was still an old man at the
time. He was probably old by the time he started writing it. That's right.
And we shouldn't be bad-mouthing Hearst. I mean, the last innovations in newspapers are all from Hearst 100 years ago. The Sunday newspaper and the comics and the long-form features and reporting overseas. We've not really improved a whole lot on that.
No, it's true. I have to tell you that my stomach falls out every time I go to the movies, which is a lot, and see that this is a Fox film. And I say, oh, God. And
more money for Rupert.
And a few times I've actually gone, and Roselle has elbowed me and said, shut up.
That's an amazing thing. Well, it's a difficult balance that we all seek. You know, painted across the top of our main conference room in the Times Union is the first tenet of the Code of Conduct of the Society of Professional Journalists. Sorry, Code of Ethics. And it is seek the truth and report it fully. And I always tell people that the difficult part is that report it fully, because you can report a story adequately by giving the he said, she said. Reporting it fully requires a great deal of energy, which I always say is second only to intelligence in the qualification to be a journalist. And the energy means that you have to make the extra phone call, go the extra mile. And often when you do that, you will get a story that is not perfectly balanced, but that does guide you toward the truth.
That Walter Winchell, who really promoted the idea of objectivity, did not mean it the way we use it now, to have no opinion, the voice out of nowhere. He meant it that you're as passionate about one side as you are the other, and you make people feel the way people on two different sides of an argument feel. Now, that's what you're talking about, fully reporting a story from completely different angles. That's very hard to do.
A very good point. And, you know, you take a look at New York State, where Andrew Cuomo is obviously thinking about a trajectory to be president. And, you know, a group comes along and they say, we're not going to endorse you for a third party, the Working Families Party. We're not going to endorse you. And there's hell to pay and there's all kinds of stuff. And in the end, he gets endorsed. Well, there's a good point that Rex is making, and his people did it very well. You have to then go in and find out what the various sides were, how much the Cuomo people threw into the mix, how desperate they were to make sure that this wasn't going to happen, what promises were made, and what promises were likely to be kept as a result of his getting this nomination.
This is where you give a lie to the notion that people often mouth, saying, just tell me the facts and I'll make my decision.
Sure,
just tell me the facts. Well, so what is the fact? Is the fact what the governor said in a press release, that everything is great, that I am now allied with these people and we're seeking a progressive future? Or is the fact the story behind the story? So you can get the facts often don't tell you the
truth. It even gets worse than that. Is the fact that he won the endorsement, period, goodbye? Or is the fact that he said to get the endorsement that he would make sure that the Senate went Democratic, which, by the way, he could do tomorrow if he really wanted to, and whether or not he was going to do it or not? And that we'll have to see, because there are many people who believe he was the one who set it up in the first place, that the Senate stayed Republican.
All of that is true. If you, again, wish to talk with us, media at WAMC.org is a way. Finally, to end on a lighter note, journalists tend to think fondly of their old editors who were really often jerks. Did you ever have a bad boss, a bad city editor or something?
Do I have to make it singular?
And by the way, the picture I think they used in the article about this was the Spider-Man guy.
Yeah, the guy.
Jameson.
Jonah Jameson, that's it, right. And we all have had these
horrible
vindictive
men.
Yeah. Well, they were mostly men, of course.
They were all men. What are you talking about?
They were
all men
and often sexist.
Mm-hmm. Right. And yet we all look back on that and say, it was tough, but by God, I was one of Joe's guys. I learned a lot. And it's just ridiculous. You know, you don't really need to have nastiness to operate journalism. I think that in previous eras, there was so much alcohol and nastiness in the pursuit of stories and cynicism that that was just sort of the way things emerged. Nowadays, you know, we'd be brought up on civil rights charges.
Yeah, I really do think that's true. There's a difference between newsmaking, running a newsroom, and management. And they didn't know it in those days. So it was just the same methods they used with friends and pals they would use on coworkers. And yeah.
The time is up for the Media Project this week. We'll hope to see you all again next week on the Media Project.
I have known, for I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers, plain and fancy.